Welcome to Mucho Radio, where we share African descent stories our way. My name is Murat Nahimana. I'm a Mucho Radio Young Journalist and Black Diplomats Academy 2023 Fellow. Our guest today is Honorable Mary Lou McFedrin, the Independent Senator of Manitoba. For those who don't know you, who is Mary Lou McFedrin?
Well, I would start by saying thank you, Murat, to you for this opportunity to have this interview with you, and say that I, in many ways, I think my childhood shaped who I am as an adult. I was raised in a small prairie town called Neepawa, Manitoba, with two younger sisters, and my dad was a large animal veterinarian who was away a lot. He used a plane to get to a lot of the farms that he was going to. And so we were really raised in many ways quite independently. So we would go off on our own. And those were obviously days long before anything like a cell phone. And basically nobody knew who we were till we showed up at the end of the day when we got hungry. And that kind of independence has really been a part of my life ever since I was a child. It shows up where I work now in the Senate of Canada in the fact that I'm not part of any of the groups that are defined, the political groups that are defined inside the Senate. And that has really suited me, who I am, much better than having to deal with leadership that sometimes I would find very difficult to comprehend.
Talking about inspiration, see, my parents are from Burundi, and Mandela was a peacemaker for our country. So to have in Winnipeg the Human Rights Museum with the biggest Nelson Mandela exhibition, what does it mean to you to have such an exhibition in Winnipeg?
Well, I'm very, very lucky because my home in Winnipeg is 21 floors up and I look straight out to the Canadian Museum of Human Rights whenever I look out my window. And that itself is inspiring. The architecture is inspiring. Have you had a chance to visit?
No, I haven't visited Winnipeg yet, but it's on my bucket list.
Good, because when the museum was being designed and built, the leader in the Winnipeg community, who was the person primarily responsible for making the museum reality, is an amazing woman named Gail Asper. And Gail Asper kept saying to the people of Winnipeg, when we get this museum done, it will be the first and only museum in the world dedicated exclusively to human rights. And the architecture needs to reflect that, because people are going to start to come to Winnipeg because they want to visit this museum. And that has happened. That has definitely happened. And the museum is a very unusual structure. There's nothing else like it that looks quite like it at this point anywhere in the world. And it works its way as a spiral up to a tower, which is called the Tower of Hope, which is entirely glass. And so not that many people have the perspective I do of being able to look at the museum from a bit of a distance, but to see all of it and to see it at night. And it always is like a shining beacon of light on the plains of Manitoba. It's also built at what is a very significant in all of Canada, or all of Turtle Island, really, Indigenous meeting place. The Indigenous elders have said for thousands of years that there are actually four rivers at all meeting at the same place, and the museum is built right at this meeting place. Two of the rivers flow underground and you don't see them. Two of the rivers, the Red River and the Assiniboine River, are very large, powerful rivers that converge at what is called the Forks. And that is where the Canadian Museum for Human Rights is situated. And one of the things that happened in the building of the museum was the acknowledgement that this museum was being built over ancient meeting place with some very important artifacts from thousands of years of indigenous civilization. And so every one of the heavy metal supports for this museum that have to go down very deep into the earth before they were completed, when the digging was happening, indigenous elders held ceremony at the base, deep down in the earth, and left bundles, left spiritual bundles, and asked for the blessing of the ancestors for the building of this new museum. And there has been a very strong emphasis by Indigenous leaders on the need not only for the museum to be built with sensitivity and respect for Indigenous cultures, but also for every single day, for how the museum operates, for what is displayed in the museum, for the management of the museum, that Indigenous leadership needs to be part of that. Now, it's not for me as a non-Indigenous person to make a judgment on that, but I will say that it has not been an entirely smooth road. I will say that we have had some very thoughtful criticism from some of the Indigenous leaders in Winnipeg, and sometimes I think the museum has been able to pivot and respond, and other times I think it's an ongoing challenge. The current leadership of the museum is very strongly committed to being responsive. And so I think there's been less in the way of community criticism. But this will always be a tension. This will always be a responsibility that the museum is going to have to, over and over and over again, find a way to live up to those promises.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And to continue on the wave of human rights. Next year ends the African descent decade for people of African descent. Can you tell us what Canada has accomplished so far for the Black communities throughout Canada?
Well, you probably saw recently that there's a brand new Black Entrepreneurs Fund. It's never happened before. It's just been announced. It's going to happen. I can assure you that that would not have happened without leadership from Black communities in Canada outside Parliament. We now have inside Parliament a Black parliamentary caucus. It is co-chaired by my colleague, Senator Rosemary Moody, and it started being co-chaired with Member of Parliament Greg Fergus. Those were the two founding co-chairs of the Black Caucus. It's operated now for about a little, almost 4 years, so it hasn't been operating that long. And now Member of Parliament Michael Coteau is the co-chair on the House of Commons side. And I'm a member of the Black Parliamentary Caucus. When I was asked to join the caucus, because I attended meetings, but I was asked to actually come on the executive of the Black Parliamentary Caucus, and I said, guys, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm not Black. So what is this? How is it that you want me to be on the executive? And one of the senators who's on the executive wrote back and said, you are an ally, and you have been involved in most of the initiatives that we as Black parliamentarians have brought, and we want you on the executive. So I serve on the executive of the Black Parliamentary Caucus, and one of the many things actually that the caucus does is we have meetings, and voices from across Canada, not only Canada, actually we've had some where there have been international leaders, Black leaders, that have been part. I mean, this is one of the good things about being able to work remotely, because just as we're having this interview today remotely, we're able to have very meaningful conversations between members of the Black Parliamentary Caucus, as well as speakers, leaders from various community groups, business leaders, social cultural leaders. And that kind of dialogue is what makes parliamentary work better. We can't do it just in our little bubble as parliamentarians nearly as well as if we are in regular, respectful listening mode to leaders who are on the ground, out in the communities of concern. And so I think that it's true still that we have slow responses relative to what we would all like to see. I know that you're an alum of the Black Diplomats Academy. You probably know that I am a strong supporter of Candace and the Academy. And I don't like how the Black Diplomats Academy has been treated on a number of occasions by Canadian government officials. I don't like the fact that what is clearly a successful model of engagement of young Black leaders, of excellent training opportunities for engagement in multilateralism, particularly the United Nations, how for the most part it's been extremely difficult for the Black Diplomats Academy to be accepted within that sort of inner circle, if you will, in the service, but that's really not correct. But part of the idea of the Black Diplomats Academy that I really love is that it is a very good training ground for a range of the skills that are needed not only to be diplomats, but also to be very effective civil servants. And what I'm hoping, and I think we're seeing a little bit more of it, is a better, more respectful, more open response from the departments inside government that really need to be more open to different ways of training, of different ways of recruiting that we see in the way in which the Black Diplomats Academy works. And I think that the tenacity, the holding on to the vision, and the just doing it anyway attitude of the leadership of Candace and the team is really, it's difficult to sustain in the face of not actually being accepted and welcomed in some cases. And that's what it takes. That's what it takes, because the tipping point, and it's very difficult to predict when that will happen, is when officials that are the holders of the decision-making and the resources actually realize that those that want in are organized, have a clear vision, have support in the community, and they're not going to give up. And that's what I think we're seeing right now. It's that we're in a stage, in a transition with the Black Diplomats Academy. And I really give everybody, the alum like you, those that are coming into the program, those that have been out of it for a number of years, those that are leading it, all I would say on that is stay in and don't give up. It's going to shift.
Thank you very much for the much love for the Black Diplomats Academy. I actually wanted to know your thoughts on how BDA can be a game changer, and you gave me the perfect answer. So, but thanks to BDA, I had the opportunity to meet you, Senator, last year at the Toronto Dalit Global Summit for Black Diplomats Academy.
The really effective work that gets done in communities, in governments, whether it's at the local level or the provincial level or the national level or the international level, very often what you see is the most effective work is done intergenerationally. So seeing a situation where, for example, you and I could be working on a similar project and in a respectful way, knowing that we're each bringing very important parts to the whole. And so I also would say to you, I have interns in my office, parliamentary interns that come from academic programs. And I also have liaison positions in my home province for young people, because that's the primary focus of my entire time as a senator is youth engagement and supporting youth leadership. And what I see, so I've now had more than 70 parliamentary interns pass through my office in the 6+ years that I've been a senator. really what's most consistent about the parliamentary interns that do well that I see that are working with me is that A, they're looking up around above their little place in the world, and they've got connection, some connection to some community. And so what they're doing for themselves. Yes, it's a very important part of their academic program to have that parliamentary experience, but they're never doing it only for themselves. There's always something bigger that's part of why they're making that extra effort to be a parliamentary intern.
Thank you again, Senator Mary Lou, for your time with us on Mucho African Radio.
And thank you, Murat. It's been a real pleasure to speak with you, and I'm wishing you all the well. And I want you to promise, if you come to Ottawa, you're going to let me know.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was
great.
A pleasure.
A pleasure for me, too. Thanks so much.